Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
My next guest has been working to prevent and treat blindness in Australia and some of the poorest countries around the world. In 2020, he was Australian of the Year. Now, that was only a month before COVID hit Australian shores, so his role was severely interrupted with COVID restrictions. Most recently, he's been appointed as the Lieutenant Governor of South Australia. This is Dr. James Mukey. James, welcome to Nightlife.
G'day. Hi. How are you, Philip?
I'm very well. Good. Gee, when you won Australia of the Year in 2000, well, when you were appointed, I suppose, it wasn't a competition, you were devoted to raising awareness about the risk of type 2 diabetes and its implications to working age adults' vision. Now, for listeners who don't understand the link between the two, can you break it down for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had to win South Australian of the Year. That was in late 2019. And I wasn't expecting to win, but I thought, well, I'll use this platform to raise awareness, as you said, about the blinding consequences of diabetes and the fact that it's the leading cause of blindness amongst working age adults. So that really became the thing I wanted to do. And in fact, through Sight for All, we'd already been exploring ways of raising awareness of this really critical issue for Australians. And then I was very fortunate enough to win that award and then went on to the Australian of the Year, which was in January 2020. And absolutely not expecting to win that, but I was once again fortunate enough to win it. But I thought leading up to that, that I had a real a deeper responsibility, really, if I was to win the award. You know, what's Australia's biggest health crisis? Well, it's type 2 diabetes. I'm Australian of the Year. I really should use this platform to raise awareness about all of the menace that is particularly type 2 diabetes. But in terms of your question about the link between diabetes and loss of vision and blindness. So diabetes, both types, the two main types are type 1 and type 2, but type 2 makes up close to 90% of cases. So really, I've been focusing my messaging around type 2 diabetes, which is a largely avoidable man-made dietary disease. Type 1 is an autoimmune disease, which is unavoidable. It's a different, absolutely different beast. But diabetes, type 1 and type 2, damage blood vessels throughout the body, including the retina, which is the light-sensitive layer of tissue that lines inside of the backs of our eyes. And it has two main consequences. It can either cause a lack of oxygen flow through those blood vessels that are affected, and that can cause a lack of what we call ischemia within the retinal tissue. And the eye tries to heal this ischemic area by sending in blood vessels, but the blood vessels don't heal the tissue in any sensible, organized way. They actually proliferate and they're fragile. They're what we call neovascular or new blood vessels. And they can then bleed and sometimes can bleed quite dramatically. I mean, it's rare to have a sudden experience of loss of vision in both eyes, but I do have a patient that has had that experience. He actually went to bed with normal sight and woke up the next morning blind in both eyes and is still blind to this day. It's a tragic story. Fortunately, that's not a common outcome. But the commonest cause of loss of vision in diabetes, but particularly type 2 diabetes, is the damage to the fine blood vessels of the central vision area of the retina, what we call the macula. And you get leakage of fluid into the tissue, which can cause blurring and distortion of vision.
In the lead up to winning the award, you told the ABC a story about a man named Neil Hansel. Now, it's an extremely touching and eye-opening account of someone who was impacted by the issues you're speaking about. Can you just tell that story again for us?
Yes, and that's what I mentioned a moment ago, actually. So Neil, I actually met in late 2018. I was wanting to do a little documentary, which featured a series of talking heads, essentially, of people who had experienced blindness, and I selected 10 people, four who were blind from birth, so four children who are blind from birth, four elderly who were slowly going blind at the end of their life due to a condition called age-related macular degeneration, which is the leading cause of blindness in adults and certainly in our society. And then there were two people who suddenly went blind in the prime of their life, and they both went blind due to diabetes. But one of the subjects, his name was Neil Hansel. I hadn't met him before. I'd just understood that he had lost vision in both eyes and thought it'd be really interesting to have a chat with him. So he came along and I interviewed him for an hour and a half, and it was the most gut-wrenching, devastating story. So Neil, at the age of 50, and unfortunately, and he's the first to admit he'd neglected his health, and then he was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes at the age of 26, and then really neglected his disease. And over those years, he had a family, had four kids, really most of his energies went into making sure they were fit and healthy, and was neglecting himself. Not an uncommon story. So he hadn't had his eyes checked on the regular basis, which is so critical for people with diabetes. As I mentioned earlier, he went to bed one evening at the age of 50 with a completely normal sight of what he was aware of, and then the next morning woke up absolutely blind in both eyes. And he actually tells the story of waking up and thought he was just dreaming. So he went back to sleep and then woke up again, and he was still blind and
completely terrified. Completely terrifying. He woke up and he couldn't see anything. It was just darkness.
Just darkness. Yep. And he talks even to this day. So he's still blind. He did have urgent surgery. One of my colleagues, who's a retinal surgeon, operated on Neil. I think there were a number of operations. I don't know all the details, and unfortunately were unable to retrieve his sight. Sometimes the bleeding is so devastating.
It's a horrifying story. I think most people would probably think, oh, this is a gradual thing, you know, gradually go blind. To go to bed with normal sight and wake up completely blind, stuff of nightmares.
It's the stuff of nightmares. It's absolutely a nightmare for Neil, and to this day, you know, his life has been devastated by this. And yet it should not happen. It should not happen for two reasons. One, that, as I mentioned before, type 2 diabetes is largely a preventable disease. It should not be in our society, full stop. But then if you develop diabetes, whatever sort, you know that there's a risk of losing vision, going blind. And so what needs to happen is you have regular eye checks. And those eye checks might happen every 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 2 years. But the idea is to pick up any vision-threatening disease before it reaches the stage where it's irreversible. And so if you pick up the disease early, you can implement particular treatments to try and stop that horrendous outcome. Now, the problem in Australia and also in the rest of the world, but certainly in Australia, there are about 1.7 to 1.9 million people with diabetes, and well over half are not having these regular, critical, all-important sight-saving eye checks. And that's why it's become such a blinding problem in our society. So absolutely one of the things that I was trying to do in my year as Australian of the Year was encourage people to, if they have diabetes, if there's someone in the family who has diabetes, make sure they're getting the regular eye checks.
So if you have an eye check, can you do something about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mentioned before that there's this risk of sudden bleed into the eye. Usually it's not as sudden and dramatic. Well, most of the time it's not as sudden and dramatic as what happened in Neil. Usually you'll get a little spurt of blood into the eye, and that will cause sudden appearance of floaters, or perhaps, you know, sudden loss of vision in one eye due to a massive bleed. But both eyes is pretty unusual. So, but if the patient is coming in for regular checks, we should be able to pick up those new blood vessels that are growing there. And the common treatment for new blood vessels is to perform laser treatment to a significant area of the retina outside the central vision area. And what that does is allow regression of those new blood vessels and hopefully allow the blinding consequences due to bleeding to abate. So that's the idea there. With the swelling at the central vision area, that's often a very gradual process, because the fluid slowly builds up at the central vision area, and you know, it can be quite advanced sometimes. But again, if you're having regular eye checks, we should be able to pick up once it starts to get to the vision-threatening stage, and then we can implement treatments. And the commonest treatment for what we call diabetic maculopathy or diabetic macular edema, so the edema or swelling at the macula, the central vision area, the commonest treatment involves injections into the eye. Sounds horrendous. But most people don't even feel it, which is kind of reassuring. I always tell patients, it sounds horrendous, but you'll be saying to me after the treatment, oh, was that it? You know, and that's absolutely the case. But the injection, we inject an antibody into the the vitreous cavity, the jelly at the back of the eye, and from there it reaches the retinal tissue and in essence seals up those leaky blood vessels, allows the edema, the swelling to reabsorb, and hopefully the vision to improve or at least stabilize. But it's not a one-off cure. So patients with diabetes generally would have a monthly injection into their eye for about 6 months. And if they've had a good response, we might then start to extend out 6, 8, 10, 12 weekly, even beyond. And sometimes we can stop. If the big driver for the diabetes and its complications, which is high insulin level in the blood, high glucose level in the blood, if that continues on, then the patients remain at risk for further retinal complications, so they need to keep on being checked.
Yeah, all right. We're talking with Dr. James Mukey. Now, James was he's an eye doctor and is passionate about eye health, and as an ophthalmologist, of course, is passionate about raising awareness about the risk of type 2 diabetes. James was 2020 Australian of the Year. These days he's still practicing, of course, and Lieutenant Governor of South Australia. Can we talk a bit about the time you were Australian of the Year? It's a goal. It's a great platform, isn't it? I mean, and you said at the time 2020 is such an auspicious year for eyesight, and so it must have seemed, and not taking anything away from that. But, of course, we were still grappling when you were appointed, we're still grappling with the devastating fires and the Black Summer bushfires of 2019-20, and then not long after, of course, we're into the lockdowns. Tell me about that year for you and what you'd hoped to do and how the lockdowns and the pandemic and COVID generally affected what you're hoping to achieve.
Within, let's say, 2, 3, 4 weeks, my whole year was booked up with speaking engagements, an extraordinary opportunity. It quite literally, it was a jigsaw.
Was that right? Like really, within weeks, every speaking engagement for the rest of the year was blocked up.
I think I had something like, within that first month of receiving the award, I had something like 70 speaking engagements. That was just in the first month.
Did you have anybody to help you with this?
I had the Australia Day Council, the National Council, had a PA essentially appointed to me. Right. But most of the emails were coming into me. So I was getting this bombardment of emails and requests that I had to field, and then, you know, starting to make sense of them and kind of work out the jigsaw puzzle, because I still was continuing on in my clinical role. I still had not-for-profit Sight for All, which I was still being involved in. Richard Harris, the year before, he went up to the Hero Cave Rescue. He actually took the whole year off to dedicate to the role, but I thought I could somehow manage it.
So you kept seeing patients during the year, did you?
Yeah, but actually when COVID struck, so several things happened. One, my clinical job was impacted and my patient numbers sort of dropped to about a third in that first couple of months, you know, from March for a couple of months. My not-for-profit job, Sight for All, which I chair, that really wound right back, because a lot of the work we do centres around hands-on training, bringing colleagues to Australia and taking teams of colleagues to partner countries. Of course, that didn't happen. And then my Australian of the Year role, which was going to be travelling around the country and internationally, quite literally all of those opportunities within a couple of months had pretty much gone. And so that 70-odd speaking engagements, nothing more really rolled in, and virtually all of those were either postponed or cancelled or put on hold. And I was left in early March with kind of literally nothing to do.
I can imagine, because that's right, because the whole year, you know, we're handing out specially printed cancelled T-shirts here at our workplace because everything was cancelled, wasn't it? And that must have been frustrating for you in a way.
It was, but it gave me some time. And I had been because I knew, in essence, my clinical job was coming to an end at some time because of my hand. I was preparing for the next phase. I'm too young to retire completely. So I actually was starting to look at the opportunity to do some keynote speaking. So I actually had been working on some keynotes. And so what I did was spend that couple of months really fine-tuning those keynotes and also making them Zoom ready, you know, so speaking live to an audience is quite different from speaking on Zoom. So I actually fine-tuned and really crafted those presentations, and then started reaching out to organizations, associations, saying, "Well, here I am, Australian of the Year. Do you want me to come and do you want me to speak? Do you want me to give a webinar?" And then it started to build up from there, and ended up being quite a a big, busy, interesting year. I think by the end of the year, so really nothing much happened until pretty much towards the middle of the year.
Right.
By the end of the year, I'd given 70 webinars. I'd been involved in 30 podcasts. I'd given over 20 live presentations, but of course they were all in Adelaide and just a small groups, and that was all in the second half of the year.
Looking at the leading cause of blindness, as you say, it's type 2 diabetes, and it's impacting nearly 1 in 10 Australians. It's the fastest growing cause of vision loss in Aboriginal people.
As well, absolutely.
As well as the sixth biggest killer in the country. And around the world, 80% of world blindness, you say, is avoidable. Almost 90% in poor countries. You say to some extent we ought to be treating blindness as a human rights issue because it doesn't have to happen to people.
Exactly. It's particularly when the majority, 90% of blindness is in, as you say, poorer countries, and 90% of that blindness is preventable or treatable. So it's what we call avoidable blindness. Mm. It quite literally shouldn't be. And I can give you a number of examples to really back up, you know, why it should be a human rights issue. Is that I've been involved in a number of childhood blindness studies throughout Asia, and one, the very first one, which was really the most memorable one, was in Myanmar in 2007. And we visited something like 7 schools for the blind across the country, and we analysed, assessed, examined all of the children who were blind at these schools. And what we found that nearly half the kids had blindness that could have been prevented or treated. So half were needlessly blind, shouldn't even be at those schools. But the thing which was so powerful, so confronting, was the leading cause of blindness that we discovered, and that was measles. You know, once again, an entirely avoidable cause of vision loss and blindness. Cost less than $1 to vaccinate, immunize the child against measles. And so measles blinds irreversibly, but the blinds in a painful and horribly disfiguring way. So to be surrounded by children who are blind and horribly disfigured irreversibly and needlessly was one of the most absolutely confronting experiences of my clinical career. And gave me a big impetus to want to do something about it. And you can imagine the team every evening, we'd be doing a little bit of a debrief about the day's experiences and just heads in hands, just devastated by what we'd seen. Anyway, I got home from that very first study and realised that what we needed to do, once I'd written up the results and once we'd analysed the data and realised what the impact was, quite clearly what Myanmar, a country of over 50 million people at the time, needed was a children's eye specialist, a paediatric ophthalmologist. So on the back of that study, we realised, and Sightful was just in its infancy back then, we realised what we needed to do was train a children's eye specialist for the country. So I went back, I took the results, I took the publication or the paper that we'd published in an international journal, and I met with the health minister and I laid it on his lap, and he had a look at it and looked up at me and said, oh, you know, I thought we were doing better. Well, clearly we weren't doing better. And so what it did allow was for us to facilitate the training of a paediatric ophthalmologist at the Women's and Children's Hospital in Adelaide. And so Dr. Tan Tun Ong is his name, and he came and spent a year at the Women's and Children's with myself and my colleagues. And he had a year of hands-on training. And then he went back at the end of that year as the very first children's eye specialist for his country. And we set him up in the country's very first children's eye centre where he works to this day.
Fantastic.
And his impact has been quite extraordinary. He now provides close to 30,000 treatments to kids every year, which is staggering in itself. But what's even more impressive, as his confidence and competence grew, he started training his own colleagues. So in 2015, he finished training the second paediatric ophthalmologist for the country. And he now trains at least 2 every year. So, you know, it's quite astonishing the work that he's doing and the impact, the sustainable impact, which really is a hallmark of Sightful's work. And that's just one example. But again, it just shows you, you know, here was a country whose children were being devastated by an avoidable cause of blindness, and yet they didn't have anyone to advocate for children or to treat children.
Yeah. Around the world, I mean, there's some people argue that it's not so much, I mean, as well as personal responsibility for diabetes and diet and so on, you should exercise personal responsibility. There needs to be some corporate responsibility too. And people say, well, look, you know, we ought to institute a sugar tax so that people, the diabetes, which is, you know, linked to sugar intake, is reduced in that way. What do you think about that?
Yeah, interestingly, so I gave my speech January 2020 and basically for I had an all-in question and answer session after I gave my speech, and then all the following week I had press and media and opportunities, and it was all about Dr. Miki calling for a sugar tax, and I constantly had to pull the media up saying, this is just one of many strategies. You know, this is a multi-pronged approach. You know, just a sugar tax is not going to cut it.
Of itself, no.
No, absolutely not. And so I constantly had to talk about, and I actually came up with this concept called the five A's of sugar toxicity. And just very quickly, first A is addiction. So sugar is highly addictive. It's as addictive as nicotine. And certainly the food industry absolutely know that, and they prey on people's addictions. Second A is alleviation. We often use sugar to alleviate stress or to make us feel better when we're down. Third A is accessibility. Sugar is cheap and absolutely everywhere. You'll know yourself. You go into the service station and you're confronted by a wall of confectionery. You can't check out from most supermarkets, stores, post offices, even chemists these days without being enticed by half-price sugary drinks and chocolates. Fourth A is addition. So something like 75% of our food and drinks have added sugar. And the final A is advertising. So our world is flooded with ads and TV commercials for sugary products. And once again, in a really predatory way.
All right. Yep, I know. There's a lot to be done. A lot to be done. Well, and you have done more than your fair share of it too, I would say. Dr. Miki, it's been terrific to talk with you, and thanks for giving us your time and reflection on your period as Australian of the Year in 2020. I do thank you for your time.
Thank you too, Philip. Really enjoyed it. All the best.
All the best to you too. Dr. James Miki, as I say, was in 2020, he was Australian of the Year. And more recently, he's been appointed as the Lieutenant Governor of South Australia. But what a time to be appointed as Australian of the Year with all the attention on you. And then, of course, along comes COVID. But as you can see, and I hope you gleaned from that interview too, he's a very passionate Australian and passionate about something which is readily treatable and amenable to treatment as well.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.